You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. NASA has given the Space Shuttle Discovery a go for launch, now scheduled for less than 2 weeks away on July 13th. Former NASA Chief Sean O'Keefe said that the grounded shuttle fleet would not fly unless and until the space agency met the safety requirements set forth by a panel investigating the causes of the 2003 Columbia disaster. The accident board made 15 safety recommendations it said NASA should address before flights are resumed. Well, this week, the task force formed to track the space agency's progress said NASA had met 12 of the 15 safety improvements. The safety concerns still outstanding are major ones, such as finding a way in space to fix a hole in the shuttle should one occur, eliminating the possibility of debris damage from foam or ice falling from the external fuel tank, that the same chain of events that led to Columbia burning up in the atmosphere and the loss of the entire shuttle crew. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about how ready is this shuttle to return to flight. If all the safety recommendations haven't been satisfied, maybe that nothing can ever be 100% satisfactory, and space still is a risky place. Plus, a report out last week from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences says U.S. space policy is not on the right course. We'll talk with one of the study's co-authors, a former head of the Johnson Space Center, about what needs to be done to get the U.S. back on track. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. George Abbey is the co-author of a new report out, as I mentioned, from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences called U.S. Space Policy Challenges and Opportunities. He was the director of the Johnson Space Center from 1995 to 2001. He's a senior fellow for space policy at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston. He joins us today from the campus there. Welcome to the program, Mr. Abbey.
Well, it's very good to be with you.
Thank you. John Logsdon was a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. He is the director of the Space Policy Institute and professor of international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University in Washington. He joins us from Bethesda. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Logsdon.
Good afternoon, Ira. Hi, George.
Hey, John.
Richard Harris is an NPR science correspondent in Washington. He joins us from our NPR studios. Welcome back, Richard.
Always a pleasure, Ira.
Yeah, let's start off with you, Richard. Tell us about this launch date. NASA has set the launch date for July 13th, despite a report this week that some safety issues remain. Tell us about some of those issues that that have not been taken care of.
Well, it was not for want of trying, I'll say that. This has been NASA has put an enormous amount of effort, and everyone gives them great credit for really tackling these problems as best they can. But you mentioned that there are three issues that really have not been dealt with completely to the letter or even the intent of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, and that includes, first of all, really being confident that debris is not going to fall off the shuttle's external tank or other parts during launch and hit the shuttle and potentially damage the shuttle. The second one was the idea was to try to make the shuttle tough enough to take that kind of punishment, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, the efforts to do that fell short of what they hoped they could accomplish within reasonable time frame and money and so on. More time, I think, than anything else. And the third was the hope that there would be a way to repair the space shuttle in orbit once, if and when there was damage detected on it. And it turns out that that turns out to be a much, much more difficult right. task than folks had hoped. And maybe John Logsdon can talk about that a little bit more since he was on the Columbia Accident Investigation Board that dealt with that. But this flight will actually test out some of those repair techniques while they're up there. But they basically are all untested. And so no one says they're comfortable enough with the repair techniques to rely on them. So they have to be experimental at this point.
Yeah, and this flight is being deemed an experimental flight to test out these things. Let's talk about that external fuel tank. The fuel tank itself has been redesigned, has it not?
They have done a number of repairs and upgrades to the external fuel tank, absolutely. The main thing they did was got rid of this huge chunk or wedge of foam that was on the tank that was part of the insulation system for the tank. The insulation is absolutely essential because you don't want ice to form on this tank, and it's full of all of these super cold fluids. So you absolutely need to to do that. And they got rid of that huge piece of foam, and in its place they've put some heaters there, so as a way of preventing the ice from building up there. And they've done a number of other things to reduce the risk that foam will flake off. But the reality is that there is really no absolute assurances that you can completely get rid of the risk of foam falling off this tank. There's just the technology just isn't there.
And so the administration, Mr. Administrator Griffin has said this is a risky business still, right?
He said absolutely. There's no such thing as 100% guarantee. Absolutely.
John Logsdon, you were a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. You figured out what caused the accident, that the board did, and issued those safety recommendations. Did the panel say that the shuttle should be grounded until all these upgrades can be done? 12 out of 15, not good enough?
No, I think what we said was it would be very good if NASA could accomplish all 15 of these recommendations. But what we were trying to do is break the causal chain between debris shedding from the external tank and killing astronauts. And there are lots of places to break that chain, and I think it has been broken in enough places. And NASA's done a really intense and scrupulous job of trying to attack these issues of debris shedding. So certainly no large pieces are going to come off again, we hope. So I think, and the chairman of our board, Admiral Hal Gaiman, has said that we think that the spirit of our recommendations has been met, and we see no reason why NASA can't make a judgment to fly.
Mm-hmm. So you just have to live with the possibility that something could break off and damage it, and you have no way to fix it in space.
Well,
that's the risk.
Yeah, but that's an extreme possibility. What you realize is that you can't reduce the risk to zero except by staying on the ground. But you can reduce risks that you know about and can work on, and I think NASA has done that. So as Mike Griffin said yesterday, this is likely to be the least risky shuttle ever flown.
But it was NASA who tried to take those risks, tell us you could take those risks away, anybody could go into space, or the teacher in space program, things like the journalist in space program. They're the ones who tried to talk us into that. And I think most of us knew that there were always going to be risks.
Well, I think George might want to comment on that also, since he was in a position of making judgments of when it was safe enough to fly. But there was a bit of a myth surrounding the shuttle that it was routine, that it could be operated on a regular basis, that it didn't need exacting care every time it flew. And I think Columbia and our investigation showed that indeed was a myth, and that it was always going to be a developmental vehicle, a rather fragile vehicle, and riskier than probably you would want in the long run, but the best we've got.
George Abbey, agree with that?
Well, yes, I agree with John. Flying in space is a risky business, and I think flying the shuttle has always been associated with risk, and it's not a routine thing to do. And what you want to do is minimize that risk. You have to pay a lot of attention to detail and be right 100% of the time. So I think what NASA is trying to do is to minimize the possibility of debris coming off the tank, because you want to eliminate that problem. And then they have put a great deal of effort into trying to come up with repair techniques. But you want to try and reduce the risk, as John says. But there will always be risks there, and there always was.
In the overall plan of the shuttle was supposed to be put out of service by this time in its lifetime, was it not? We were supposed to be on our way to the next generation of spacecraft. And
well, it depends on what point in time you look at, Ira. At the time of Columbia accident, NASA was planning to fly the shuttle to 2020 or perhaps even beyond, because there was no replacement in sight. At different points, there have been attempts to develop a replacement, none of which have been successful. Now we've set a date firm of 2010 to retire the system, and NASA is trying to accelerate the development of the replacement system for carrying people to space.
So what can you do in 5 years? I mean, why hold off retirement till 2010? We don't seem to be having a whole lot of success with the space station in orbit. Only a couple of people on board there, not much happening. George Abbey, why not just accelerate that?
Well, I think the space station really requires a shuttle. It takes a shuttle to take up the modules that we've agreed to fly for our international partners. You also need to take up sizable amounts of cargo to make the space station productive. You also need the downmass that's provided by the shuttle. So I think the fact that we're not going to fly the shuttle past 2010 does pose a real problem for the future of the space station and certainly poses a problem for our international partners.
Let's get into that a bit, because you and Neil Lane co-authored a report released last week that looks at the current state of U.S. space policy, and you identified four failures in this country's space plan. Let's talk about them. First, the arms trade restrictions. What does that do for us?
Well, I think we have come up with very challenging export controls that make it very difficult for other countries to work on cooperative ventures with us, and it makes it very difficult for our industry to compete on the world market, because when you are buying a satellite from another country, mm-hmm. buying it here in the U.S., our restrictions on what access or the access of that data to that foreign country or that company, they don't get the information they need in order to operate or fly their satellite. And it's also difficult when they try to launch on one of our launch vehicles. And for that reason, these countries and these companies and other places around the world are going to other countries to buy their satellites and also to get their launches.
Mm-hmm. We also, point number two you make is that we've talked about many times, the decline in U.S. science and engineering workforce, universities, how many scientists and engineers. Can we create the future in space if we don't have those engineers here anymore?
No, and I think that's a very, very critical problem, because the enrollment in science and engineering across the country at our universities is going down. And if you look at the future and what we have to do in order to maintain a preeminence in space, our technology is really going to be what carries us through. And without those young people coming along to make those advances in technology, really puts our future in jeopardy.
And also, another point you make is that NASA's plan, as expressly expressed by the president many times, for future missions to the moon and Mars, manned missions to the moon and Mars, these things are just not going to work out the way we're headed that direction.
Well, I think you have to be realistic about what those kind of missions will cost and be willing to put that kind of investment that's needed in order to achieve successful missions to the moon and to Mars. But also, you don't want to do it to the detriment of our other activities, the other activities that NASA pursues, what you just discussed about the impact of the comet. We do a lot of robotic missions, and we have, I think, had a great deal of success in our science, our astronomy, our earth sciences and earth observation activities. And you don't want to have NASA's focus so dominant that you're cutting back on those activities. And also aeronautics. I think aeronautical research is important to NASA. Mm-hmm. So what you need to have is really a balanced program and recognize what it's going to cost.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the future of the shuttle space flight and other missions in space on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And, of course, the fact that if you have a lot of money that's being drawn off by a manned or person space mission, that draws off money from other science that NASA might be doing.
That's correct. And I don't think you want to have everything just focused on human missions. You need to have a balanced program.
John Loxton, do you agree with the future here? It doesn't look so bright.
Well, no, I don't agree, and I agree with a lot that is in the paper by George Abbey and Neil Lane. I think with respect to export control, the situation's even worse than they paint. They talk about commercial competition, but this is hurting our ability to collaborate scientifically with other countries. It's an extremely burdensome system that really is inappropriate for the kind of interactions we have in the civil sector and needs to be addressed. I do agree with totally with the notion that we need to replace our feedstock in terms of scientists and engineers, and an exciting space program attracts a lot of people to science and engineering education. That happened during Apollo. There were lots of people that went into engineering that never worked on the space program but contributed to other parts of society. With respect to the long-range direction of the program, which is where I think that George and I probably both agree and disagree, the president has set out a vision in reaction to a criticism of the Columbia board. We said that there was no compelling rationale for putting humans in space, and the White House read that and said, all right, we'll develop one, and that one is a sustained human and robotic partnership to explore the solar system and beyond, first back to the moon, eventually to Mars, and then who knows where. There's a premise there, and this is where I think Mr. Abbey and I disagree. For 30 years, the U.S. space program has been funded at about 0.7% of the federal budget, and I think that represents a public policy decision of how much money the taxpayer and the government is willing to allocate to space. What we're trying to do is carry out this program within that budget constraint rather than count on increased budgets. It would be great if the budgets would increase, but politically I don't think it's very realistic. And that means hard choices, and it means setting priorities.
Mm-hmm. What kind of money would we be talking about, if politically speaking, to see an increase in the budget that would be able to carry out what the president has in mind?
Well, just give you some standards of comparison. The money spent on NASA now is about 20% of the money spent at the peak of Apollo, one-fifth the money. Back in 1990, a group headed by Norm Augustine of Martin Marietta said we could have a very good program if the budget went up 10% a year for 10 years. That didn't happen. I don't think it's going to happen.
So it's basically not putting your money where your mouth is when you talk about, you know, going to the moon and Mars.
Well, as I say, the plan that is laid out by the Bush administration and NASA, and now new administrator Mike Griffin, is struggling to fit a reasonable program of human spaceflight into the budget ceilings. And it's fitting 100 pounds in an 80-pound bag. It's tough.
We have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to talk about why does the U.S. have to be the next country that goes to the moon or Mars? Why not a country like China, which is spending and buying things up like crazy? You know, is trying to buy Unocal, oil companies, things like that. Maybe they would buy up one of our defense contractors or one of the rocket makers or somebody like that and decide we could go to, we'll be the next people to go to the moon, and we'll take it on all ourselves. I'd like to get your opinions and also your phone calls. When we come back, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the space shuttle's return to flight, about the U.S. space policy, with my guests, John Logsdon, Professor of International Affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, Richard Harris, Science Correspondent of NPR in Washington, and George Abbey, who is the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston, Texas. He's that senior fellow there. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Richard, did you get the impression at all from the press conferences announcing this that NASA was sort of charged up for this, ready to go? Well, you know, we're eager and all set to go on the 13th.
Absolutely, I think people are have been waiting a long time for this. When the accident first developed, I think there was a sense at the time that we can fix this and get right back to it. And the Columbia Accident Investigation Board took 7 months to really figure out what had gone wrong and sort of lay out the groundwork. And I think there was hope that they'd be able to spring back, and it seemed easy enough to just fix the tank and be on the way. And it's been, you know, to NASA's credit, they've said, well, we're still not ready, and they did not rush it just for the sake of getting back into flight. But I think that people are really feeling very optimistic about it right now, or very, very, you know, anxious for it to be off, and more importantly, actually anxious for it to be back successfully. That's really what they're waiting for.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Let me pick up the thread I mentioned before the break, and that is, I'll ask first George Abbey, you know, we used to be the only game in town, and the Soviet, after the Soviet Union dropped out of the space race, and we were, you know, we did the International Space Station after the Mir got sort of fell apart of old age. We did that with other countries, but have the bulk of the responsibility of the money in getting it finished. Could there be other countries on the horizon like China? And then there are other countries who have expressed interest in going into space, and I think the Chinese have said that themselves and even talked about going to the moon. What's to keep them from, you know, becoming the new 800-pound gorilla on the block?
Well, I think China is making major investments in space, and I think as Tony Blair, when he talked to the European Parliament last week, indicated that the Chinese have tripled their investment in research over the last 5 years. So they're making major investments in the future and investments in space. So I think their vision is that they are going to go to the moon and certainly continue to explore space. And they have partnerships they've formed with Russia and with Europe. And so I think they're moving forward in space. Mm-hmm. I think as you look back at our history, the Apollo program was one where it was really the United States program, but we've really come a long ways since that time. And if you look at the International Space Station, it's a cooperative activity with the United States involved with other countries. And I think if we're going to go back to the moon and Mars, we're going to have to do that cooperatively with these other countries. And that's going to be a key factor in going to the moon and to Mars. And
has the president said that? Has the president said that we're waiting for them to, you know, chip in with us?
Well, he made the offer to him when he came out with his vision. But I think the concern is that we have already now a partnership with them on a space station, and we've made commitments to take their modules up to the station and to continue to operate the station. And without the shuttle, and if the shuttle doesn't launch their modules, we have a real credibility problem with working with our partners.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a major issue as we look at where we want to go in the future and foreign partnerships with these countries.
John Longston?
Well, certainly President Bush in January of 2004, at White House initiative, I should say, said that the United States wanted other countries to participate in carrying out this vision. The past administration at NASA was not terribly enthusiastic about that prospect, and I would say kind of slow-rolled for a number of months getting started on discussions of collaboration. But there's a new administrator now. Mike Griffin took over on April the 14th. He's energized the organization. He's got two groups doing two-month plans, one on what to do with the shuttle and station, and the other on a faster-moving exploration architecture. He met with his colleagues, international colleagues, for the first time during the Paris Air Show and said, we're here to talk. We're going to work together. We've got some problems to solve together, and it is really kind of a new beginning on our international partnership. So I'm pretty optimistic that there is a really a tough problem in terms of to fully finish the space station would take 28 shuttle flights. There are not likely to be 28 shuttle flights available between now and 2010. So how many do we fly? I would give very high odds that they will include launching the Japanese and European modules. Griffin got an earful from both the Japanese and the Europeans about how important that is, and he knew it already. So I think that the organization is on a new course, both domestically and internationally, and if the Congress provides the support, the next year can be very productive.
If something does go wrong with this mission, and I don't know, don't want to even guess what might be, is that the end of the space shuttle?
George?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult to really keep the human spaceflight program going if you have another major problem with the shuttle. I think that's going to be a real difficult task because we've made a great investment in trying to get it right and correcting the problems that led to the Columbia disaster. And if we have a problem, that's going to be a real issue for the future.
Yeah, I would agree and say that's the kind of wicked problem that Griffin is facing. He has to launch the shuttle a certain number of times to complete a useful space station, but every time he launches it, he's risking the future not only of the shuttle program, but of human spaceflight and this exploration vision. So how you find the sweet spot in that set of circumstances is really a tough issue.
Yeah, Ira, if I could chime
sure,
in here. I think that NASA has been, of course, thinking about this a lot, and there's no official number or anything, but clearly the 28 flights that John Logsdon mentioned are not all absolutely essential to be on space shuttle. Some of them are like the modules, but others are logistics flights that can possibly be accomplished in other ways. So, yeah, they are looking at how to pare that back. But the conventional wisdom is clearly if there's another loss of a vehicle, even if the astronauts survive, if the vehicle goes, there's essentially no way to maintain a space shuttle program with just two vehicles left, and NASA would just figure out what's next.
Well, let's talk about that. What is next? Is there anything scheduled on the drawing board for actual deployment, the things that are being tested, a date for, you know, we talked about when the shuttle might be taken out of service. Is there something concrete that we'll be seeing launched and tested in the public view, John?
Yeah, the plan that was laid out by President Bush in January 2004 called for retiring the shuttle in 2010 and replacing it not before 2014 with a new crew-carrying thing called the Crew Exploration Vehicle. Congress was very concerned about that four-year gap in U.S. access for people to space, and Griffin, as he went through his interviews prior to his nomination, heard that concern, shared it, and has said he is going to make every effort to accelerate the CEV program so it will be available soon after the shuttle is retired. This is, again, one of our Columbia board recommendation was to separate carrying cargo and carrying crew, not combine it on one vehicle like the shuttle. And so this will be a hopefully a simpler and much safer just crew-carrying vehicle. What's going on now is figuring out what its design should look like and how it's going to be launched.
Sort of like a space plane? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, it could be as fundamental as an old Apollo-like capsule with a reentry shield, rather than trying to push the frontiers of technology, which we did with the shuttle.
We still got those Saturn V's lying on the ground.
Unfortunately, that's where they're going to stay. It would be great if we had a heavy lift vehicle, but we don't now. It's part of the plan is to develop one.
Richard?
Yeah, well, it is hard to imagine how you could develop a new system from scratch in just a couple of years, the manned program. But we are actually going to see a new vehicle going to the space station shortly, which is the Europeans have built a cargo vessel. And so we will be seeing new space hardware and new ways to get stuff up to the space station. And the Russians have, you know, antique but very reliable methods of getting people up and down, and there are all sorts of international entanglements about whether or not we can rely on their services. But it is really hard to see how in 5 years we could have a new human vessel that would work for NASA astronauts.
Well, this is one of the points I was trying to make. Maybe America's leadership in space is over. You know, maybe our future, the best years are in the rearview mirror now.
Well,
and European and the Chinese, you know, we sit here and talk about what we're going to do and this and that. And they going ahead. They're just going to do it.
Be careful. I mean, the Chinese launched one person on a short mission in October of 2003 and haven't launched anybody since. That's not exactly a fast-paced challenge to American leadership. We still spend five times or more on our space program than any other country. So it's really getting our act together, worrying about scaring up another challenge to our leadership.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a phone call here. Let's go to Ruth in Baton Rouge. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I've really enjoyed the discussion you gentlemen have been having, and I want to put in my 2 cents worth for continuing with the effort to get out there. I think it's important to our scientific and technology development that we continue trying to find ways to get out there and have a human presence beyond the Earth. And as far as funding, I'm wondering if it would be possible. You know, on our income tax forms, we can check off a little box about funding presidential elections. Maybe we can put $1, $5 towards space exploration.
Hmm. Maybe Bert Rutan would have something to say about
it. I would love to go out there. I want to see what's out there. I'm 58 years old. I'll never get out there. But, oh, I've been a science fiction fan since I was like 10 years old. And I love reading about, you know, what if.
Right, right.
And if this happens, then what happens? And what is just ordinarily custom accepted routine when certain technological things happen? And it would be such a tragedy if we had all our eggs in one basket on this little earth and everything went.
All right, Ruth, thanks for calling.
We need to go to the moon. We need to go to Mars and beyond.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Okay.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about the future of space this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Of course, that is another equation that we haven't touched upon, a smaller part of the equation, and that is, what about privatization of space? Where, you know, we have now seen the XPRIZE was won. We've seen people who just say, give me the money and the resources, I can do it on my own. Is that, are we anywhere near the success that we might be achieved there? John, what do you think?
Well, you know, the progress so far, the spaceship one flight last September and October, flights, I should say, to win the XPRIZE was an impressive achievement. But it's not going into orbit. It's just going up and down very fast. One of my colleagues called it upside-down bungee jumping. It will come, but designing equipment to carry people safely and affordably into orbit is a real technological challenge, and it's not clear that the private sector is anywhere near having the money to make that investment.
George Abbey?
Well, I would agree with John. I think it's going to be very challenging for them to go beyond what they've done so far to get into orbit. It is a difficult task, and it's one that'll happen eventually, but it's going to be a while.
But does NASA have the skills anymore, and the personnel? The, you know, people who put us in space are retired, they haven't passed on their skills, or is NASA almost unable to take us to the next generation? You mentioned before the brain drain and now the money drain, George. Where is the future?
Well, I think that is that's going to be difficult for NASA because they haven't retained a lot of in-house capability. I think what really carried us through on the Apollo program and from that point on in the space program until we lost some of those retirees was a group that came in from NACA that had really had hands-on experience and been able to build and test and fly things themselves. And we also had, I think, the benefit of a very strong group at Huntsville, Alabama, with Wernher von Braun and his people as well. And that was a great base for us to build on. And you have to have an in-house capability. You have to have your people experienced and knowledgeable on how to build and test and fly things. And over the last few years, we have lost that capability. So that's going to be a challenge to really build that back up again. I think Mike Griffin understands that and is going to try very hard to do that, but that's going to be a challenge.
John, yep. 30 seconds, John.
I mean, the great example of that, recent example, are the Mars rovers. Those were built by an in-house team, hands-on at Jet Propulsion Lab. I think there was a direct link between that experience and the success of the mission. We need to recreate that on the human side of the ledger.
But the human side is a lot more difficult, a lot more money than the Mars mission.
More money. It's not as hard as, I mean, it's not that much harder than landing a machine on Mars.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll see what happens. This is waiting for the exciting events of July 13th, we'll see if that slips, if you have weather. This is the summertime. It's Florida, all kinds of things. We want to be extra sure when the countdown goes correct. We'll take side of office pools on what exact date that launch will occur. I want to thank all my guests, George Abbey, co-author of a report on the U.S. space policy last week for the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, director of the Johnson Space Center from 1995-2001, senior fellow for space policy at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, George.
Also, my pleasure.
You're welcome. John Logson, member of the former Columbia Accident Investigation Board, director of the Space Policy Institute, professor of international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at GWU. Thank you for taking time on this holiday weekend.
Yeah, good discussion, Ira.
Thank you. Richard Harris, always a science correspondent at NPR. Are you going to go into the launch, covering it?
Yes, I am planning to, weather permitting, as you say.
Hopefully you'll report there for us. We'll see if we can get you give us a telephone call during the space launch, if it happens on our day. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Okay.
And that's about all the time we have for this week on Science Friday. We're Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Ryan Habers in New York, Calvin Avery in Houston, and Cal Southworth in Washington. Greg Smith composed our theme music. Also want to thank Mitch Eaton, also there in Washington. I'm going to be taking a few weeks off, but Joe Palk will be sitting in for me. Please treat him at least as well as you treat me. Have a great weekend. Have a great holiday. Safe weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.